Great. So we're going to try to keep this really short and then turn to you guys for questions and feedback. The structure should be three-part. We'll first describe the nature of the project, and then which Ryan will do, and then I'll describe the book's layout and how we're trying to achieve our vision for the project, and hopefully the third section will be how we can achieve that vision online. And we'll give you our concerns about going online, and then what we think we might be able to accomplish, with the caveat that we don't know much, and then turn it to you guys for feedback. So,
great. And just feel free to interrupt us in the initial presentation, especially if there's something that's not clear, so we can clarify it immediately. The other is that we're going to lay out the book project for you, but just to give you a sense of the kinds of questions that we're interested in and that we've come here in large part to seek your your help on, and we'll outline them more specifically. One is just to promote the book project itself, the dissemination of the ideas in the book project through the internet and technology, and then the other is to extend the book project beyond the book itself into a second life or second phase for the book. You also might be aware that there was a PDF on the web that you could get after this session, or if somebody's watching it on webcast, they would be able to get it on the website, which was the initial book proposal. And the book has, in fact, evolved, but it's still, I'd say, generally within the four corners of the proposal that we had sent around to publishers. There's a third editor, Derek Jinks, at the University of Texas at Austin, who's working with Andrew and myself as editors on the book. The stage of the book is that we've secured authors for just about all of the chapters, and almost all of the authors are at the final stages of writing their chapter, so that we'll have that from them in the beginning of next month. The goal or objective of the book is motivated by the idea that in the academy there are disciplines and fields and programs of research that have focused on ideas like networks, human behavior, how norms are spread, how the mind works in terms of cognition studies and brain sciences that have not yet focused on human rights. And that's the gap. So looking outside of the legal academy into other disciplines, identifying some of the cutting-edge work done with respect to how to promote norms, how to promote social action, and then translating that or building a bridge over to the promotion of human rights. That's the goal of the project. So just to give you a sense of what that might mean, how to promote norms doesn't necessarily have to be using the state or the nation state as a unit of analysis, which often happens in international relations scholarship. It could easily be using individuals or groups at a much lower level as the unit of analysis. What motivates actors to perpetrate rights violations? What mobilizes or demobilizes individuals or groups to promote human rights? So to give you an example, from network analysis, we would take studies that have looked at how loose networks can promote change or mobilize action. Some of that work has been done translating into what mobilizes terrorist networks. And we would think that there'd be information there about reverse engineering those insights for what mobilizes political dissidents, human rights activists, and the like. Another one is experimental economics, studying issues of, to use a catchphrase, strong reciprocity. So ways in which individuals might interact with others in a social setting out of acts of benevolence or trust, and how material incentives to promote or incentivize action could in fact counteract strong reciprocity, other motivations for acting, so crowding out those motivations. So that would influence potentially at the state as a unit of analysis whether or not you use sticks or carrots and how sticks or carrots might have different effects or might crowd out other ways in which states would otherwise engage in normatively desirable behavior. Another one is just social marketing. Social marketing has been used for public health, but hasn't that been used so well for human rights and how to build a human rights campaign or what could be blowback effects from social marketing. So the ways in which the message could in fact induce actors to engage in the very action that is trying to be controlled. So social marketing, looking at the ways in which drug usage campaigns telling students on college campuses not to use drugs, in fact, encourages students to use drugs because everybody else is doing it. And the insights for that might be utilized in human rights campaigns in which rates or prevalence might actually encourage actors to think that that's a norm or accepted at some descriptive level. The idea here is, and this will be the last thing I say about it, and then Andrew will talk a little bit about the layout or the organization of the book itself, is that we're trying to build two pipelines or feedback mechanisms of information. One pipeline is between academic disciplines, so it's to have academics talk to each other and understand what is the cutting edge of their fields of research and what those applications might be into human rights scholarship and back and forth between the different disciplines. The other is very consciously trying to build a pipeline or a bridge between the academy and practice. And the idea is to have this really impact on the ground the ways in which human rights advocates might then build campaigns or decision makers might design an international treaty regime. And the thought is that that's a very important component whereby academics would be speaking to practitioners for issues of institutional design or human rights advocacy, but at the same time, those academics don't have often the ground level or field experience so that they can also learn from the practitioners, especially reflective practitioners who have thought a lot about how they're trying to build campaigns on the basis of empirical assumptions, and then they can feedback to the academics what's important to them, what's being tried, what fails, what doesn't make any sense in the real world.
Great. So I'm just going to run through the various devices that we came up with to achieve this double translation. Colin assured me that the Berkman Center, everyone at the Berkman Center would be familiar with something similar to the challenge that we faced, because when you gather a group of people who have a shared interest in a particular thing, but different disciplinary backgrounds, you have both the translation problem of moving between and across disciplines, but then moving from the academic theoretical level down to practice. And so this is what we came up with. The first, the most obvious, is just our prompts with the authors, our interactions with the authors, getting them to think about each other's projects, and then what those projects might mean for the real world, the world of policy. Authors retreat. We gathered the authors this June for a day and a half retreat to discuss each other's projects, present their work, and to look for similarities and points of discussion between each other. And we will probably gather at least some of them one more time before the project's over. The third is the workshop, which Ryan and I taught this past spring semester at the law school, which was an open forum for each contributor. Almost every one of them came to present their work and workshop it with students who would mostly push them on the implications of their work for human rights. A lot of the students also engaged with the work itself, but the thrust of it, I think, was how do we turn this into reality, policy reality. And then fourth is our introduction and our conclusion in the book. Obviously, we'll be looking for common themes and discussions between the various disciplines, and hopefully highlighting them, bringing them to the fore. The fifth is that at the end of each chapter, we'll have an applications page where we collect insights from the various chapters and say, if you were to flip through the book and you were an activist and you wanted to know what are the relevant research insights from these various fields, what does network science have to say about how human rights advocacies can best be implemented? You would flip to this page and you'd have a bullet point list, a sort of quick digest of potential action points. And we're pushing the authors to almost arrive at those conclusions themselves, but some of them aren't going all the way, in which case we'll fill that page with what we think, directions where we think the work could best be moved. And then finally, we'll have two chapters from academics, well, one academic and one activist, who will be explicitly doing the work of translation. Lee Ross, a social psychologist at Stanford, is going to look at the interactions of the various chapters and then comment on the actual project of making an interdisciplinary product. And then Bill Schultz, the former director of Amnesty International, is going to discuss the limitations and opportunities of bringing this academic work into the real world. And so we're hoping that by the end of this whole process, these six mechanisms will give us something like a gel to hold the book together and achieve this dual translation. But we're also hoping that moving this project online will help us even more. So we're curious to know what you guys think about that move and what you've encountered in work at Berkman in trying to overcome the hurdles of doing interdisciplinary work and then bringing that work into the world of policy.
And then just to add a couple notes, one is at the author's retreat that we held at the beginning of the summer, we didn't just invite the scholars themselves, but also invited around the table human rights practitioners. So a few people who work in organizations, the names which would be familiar to you, talking to them. And in fact, that was one of the most useful exchanges. We were most concerned that that wouldn't work. But in fact, it worked very well in terms of the synergy. Then also just to give you a list of the authors so that you might be familiar with these people's work and you have a sense of who's contributing to the project. Paul Slovak, Jonathan Baron, Barry Wellman, Pina D'Agostino, Herb Gintis, Russell Hardin, Bob Hornick, George Lakoff, Margaret Levy, Tom Tyler, Audrey Sachs, John McHale, Deborah Prentice, in addition to Lee Ross and Bill Schulz writing their chapters. So we're more than thrilled by the lineup of people that we've gotten. They were basically our dream list. So then the last phase that we thought of, or last part that we thought of in terms of introducing the project idea to you, is to get more specific or granular about the kinds of applications we think could be useful via the internet and technology. And this is by no means an exhaustive list. We just thought to name a few samples and get your feedback, see what you think about those ideas. But any other ideas that you have that we don't mention, we more than welcome directing that part of the conversation towards other thoughts or applications. So the way we thought to talk about this is, once again, just to remind you, phase one, phase two, maybe a shorthand. Phase one is simply promoting the book itself and the dissemination of ideas in the book. Phase two is an extension of the project. So other ways to build on this kind of a venture, interdisciplinary, and one that's melding of the academy and practice with respect to the idea of understanding social action and promoting human rights. Two caveats or variables that you might consider in proposing other ideas as to how we might galvanize the project are the caveats or factors or variables are, one, our capacity. So it's not limitless in terms of the kind of effort that we'd be able to put into these, so we have to be selective thinking about what we might do. We have had conversations with others who we would partner with who are expert in building these kinds of projects, but that's just one consideration to always think about the capacity or effort or costs that it would entail. And second is our level of risk aversion is one other caveat or factor. We thought you'd always want to know what the actor's level of risk aversion is. Ours is pretty significant. We're risk averse. So that one of the things we always discuss when we discuss applications is if it fails. And we have a low tolerance for that, in that it could really compromise, since this is such an experimental project, could really compromise the project if we try something out and it doesn't work. Like, for example, an aspect of a website that presumes there will be high level of traffic or communication by users and it doesn't pan out. That would be bad for this kind of a project, just because we chose the wrong medium to extend it. So that's one other thing just to think about or tell us about if you think that the risks line up in a certain way on some of these ideas.
So I'll just quickly describe some of the things we were thinking about for a potential website for the book. And I should say, too, that we've discussed extending this project into the web with the help of Berkman and also with the help of Osgoode Hall Law School. And we haven't decided who we're going with or what we're doing. This is incredibly early. A third option is that the book is being published by Oxford University Press, and they've recently joined up with Opinio Iuris, which is a pretty influential international law, international affairs blog. So we're one potential option would be to turn to OUP and say, what do you think? Would you guys be willing to take this on as a project, as a digital extension of the book? So I'll just go through a few of the proposed pieces of the website and then ask for feedback. And the main question is, how much interactivity should we have and what are the costs or benefits associated with each piece of interactivity? So we discussed having a blog, and we were concerned that a blog would require someone to continually update it, it would raise expectations, and then if it hadn't been updated frequently, it would look like the site would look inactive or look like a failure, when in fact there's valuable information simply in presenting the findings of the book online. So why have a blog when we could simply, the lowest level of interactivity would be to just post the action points at the end of each chapter onto a page on the blog, then any on the website that any activist could access and have a quick digest of the book. A way of ramping up the interactivity and also creating a community for human rights activists who are interested in interdisciplinary scholarship, and there are some, believe it or not, would be to create a wiki. And we've a lot. Everyone we've talked to about this project has said at some point, "Oh, you should create a wiki," but we don't want to create a wiki that has five entries and doesn't grow. And we wonder, what does it take? Do we need to hire someone full time to fill it out? Would we have to have an intern that did it for 2 years? And then, if the funding stopped and it was over after 2 years, could we seal it off so that in 8 years, if we still think this information is relevant but it hasn't been updated in 6 years, does it look like a dead project, or can we seal it off so that it looks like this project grew to its natural length and then stopped, and here it is as a finished digital archive? And then the most interesting project that we conjured up and have sort of half-baked is the idea of a human rights matrix, which would outline the various pieces of the international human rights regime. It's by no means complete, but the idea would be to list components of the regime and then potential research insights that would components of the regime and then potential failings of that regime, and then research insights or research programs that might produce insights about how that regime could be improved. So right now we have it as in this table form, and we're wondering how to put it online, and one natural way to do this would be to just turn this into a wiki and have both our contributors and any activists, scholars that we're in discussion with to fill this in with real examples from the world of policy or examples from scholarship that they know about that we don't. But the question there is how many people would use it, what if it fails, and how do we get it to be immediately digestible, because it's pretty dense. And if you don't know much about the international human rights regime, how do we explain this complicated informational apparatus in a quick digestible bite? And I was thinking we could do it as a mind map, which I'm a big fan of, but again, not sure how much people can digest from this, whether this adds anything more than a wiki would. But the idea here would be, obviously, map out the various components of the regime, and then you can just click on each. I'm sure you guys have all seen these, and expand. And obviously, easy to throw this onto a website, but less easy, I think, is having it be collaborative the way that a wiki would. But maybe I'm wrong, and hopefully you'll correct me. So do you want to say anything more about the matrix?
Yeah, so you get the concept of the matrix is simply to identify elements or characteristics of the human rights regime, and what we mean by that are, who are the actors that promote human rights, who are the institutions that promote human rights, who are the actors that are the target audience for the message of human rights. So it might be intermediate actors like a legislature that's then going to sanction another country, or it might be the final target, which is the perpetrator. And then once you identify the regime, also what are the enforcement mechanisms or norm promotion mechanisms within international institutions? Is it economic sanctions? Is it norm promotion? Is it education? The idea is that we would create this map of the human rights regime from individual actors to institutions. It's also a good introduction for people who have not yet focused on human rights, just to see what are the various elements. Once you have the elements, that's kind of one column in that table. Then the next is what are the empirical assumptions of how those elements act or are influenced. Then the third is what interdisciplinary research or other disciplinary research questions or qualifies or supports those empirical assumptions. So for example, some empirical evidence qualifying or questioning assumptions of empathy, and that there's empathy failure at a certain level when you quantify human life beyond a certain number, that people actually just, it drowns out their ability to attend to those questions, Paul Slovak's work on that. So that would have some, and then you would design the institution differently in light of empathy failure. So that would be the application at the end of the day. So that's the idea, and that's why we call it a matrix, partly to reflect its complexity.
Yeah.
What people could add in terms of content, are new insights or research that does question certain assumptions. Or they could just add in the application. So they know about motivation crowding out theory in experimental economics and think about the ways in which the human rights regime is currently predicated on instrumental calculations of rational actors, and then say, well, here are some applications as to how that would throw into question existing modes of activism or institutional design. So that's the purpose of the matrix.
The other thing we haven't quite figured out yet, and I would love to be able to do, is somehow show simultaneously the field of relevant social science research insights and compare it to how it would map onto the human rights regime. Right now we have this sort of linear, here's the regime, here's the gap, here's where we think we're doing the work of placing the research insight next to where we think the gap is. But if you were to just look at the regime, you would see that a lot of attention is placed on rule enforcement and official legal mechanisms for promoting or enforcing human rights, and there isn't a ton of attention placed on education and media campaigns, but there's an enormous amount of social science research on how norm promotion happens, how norm internalization occurs, and it's always linked or often linked to education and media, and so you might immediately see that gap between what the insights are saying and what the regime is doing. And then be able to say, well, here's, you know, these insights could be ported over here, and the implications would be that the regime would be shifted like this. But the map and the matrix aren't laid out in such a way that you would immediately come to that conclusion now. So I think that's it. If we can turn it to you guys for feedback about creating online communities or about doing interdisciplinary work online, or achieving critical mass to create wikis. We are not sure. Yeah.
I'm really intrigued by what you're doing and the breadth of your ambition. One of the things that worked on the last 4 years, we organized multidisciplinary workshops at evolutionary biologists, behavioral economists, a lot of the people you're talking to, and because there's so many insights that are coming out of neuroscience that actually are changing how we look at rational actors, and so there's a big shift in that. What I found is it's very difficult to get those insights, so the people who, that's one kind of community, one way of thinking, then to map it into practice, and then map that into technology. I mean, you're making three big leaps.
Yeah.
And so in terms of a long tail, you may have a very long tail.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, so you have this concern about getting usage, but if you organize it, I think in such a way, you may have intense interest around certain areas. I mean, they may roll up into common interest. Mm-hmm. So the architecture is very important. I mean, if you try to do common denominator, I think it'll be low.
Yeah.
Because there's not going to be a lot of Venn diagrams.
Intersect.
So there are, and one of the things that we're doing going forward is a great point of collaboration. We're forming something called the Law Lab, which is to create a cloud that basically allows you to run experiments in digital institutions, implementation systems, and how to share information.
Interesting.
So, it's also highly multidisciplinary. Yochai Bank was very much involved in this, and so I think that'd be definitely a point of contact.
Yeah.
But my own experience is that I think these things are really profoundly affect how you think about the intervention points.
Yeah.
But that you have different communities and you have a different incentive structures that. you're between a lot of different stools, you know?
Yeah.
And yet you have to change that conversation. So there is sort of what is the pragmatic outcome? What are the interventions? How can I use this thing? How do I do something differently now than I've ever done before?
Yeah.
That's one way of navigating this information versus an academic.
The other way of phrasing it, though, I should have said, instead of just presenting it as we're afraid that we won't achieve a critical mass,
right,
is even if we don't achieve a critical mass, surely there's some midpoint where we could create a device that would look, that would be somewhat sealed off so that it doesn't look like it's an ongoing project, but no one's contributed to it and it's dead. But it can exist until the long tail kicks in, until there is enough interest in this project. But the question for us is, what does that look like? And we're really not sure.
Well, realistically, even if you have, say, thousands of people who are viewing this page, the vast majority of the content is going to be supplied by a handful of people. And so I think in terms of creating and maintaining a vital presence and content-providing presence, you really need to do the human work of recruiting the specific people that you think you want to be contributing to it, and then sussing out whether or not they'll actually be able to get involved, and seeing what sorts of reward structures need to be put in place,
yeah,
and such that it's worth it for them.
Okay.
And I think maybe not full time, but you definitely should have somebody part of whose job it is to maintain those relationships, to go in and do just general cleaning up work, but somebody who keeps the ball rolling, because it almost certainly won't keep, even if it's kind of a success, it won't keep rolling on its own.
That being said, I think that the nature of what you're describing is crying out for a tended wiki.
Yeah.
As Jacob's describing, because you're saying, look, this is all about interconnectivity that people haven't noticed before. In your workshop or your retreat, you're saying that you're doing this kind of benevolent guidance, like, hey, have you guys thought maybe you should have a conversation? Oh, wow, great, what insights. And the online space is particularly fruitful for that, because you can render those connections, you can reify them, they're visible.
Yeah.
And so I think that if you can get, even if it's in the initial, whatever your time frame is, you said it was like 2 years or something like that. Whatever you're willing to be proactive with, based on the limitations you described and your resources, if you can say, look, you know, can you get me an article? Can you link it? If you can get it to not necessarily a critical mass, but like a threshold, then it will be just what you described. It'll be a useful resource. Somebody comes like, hey, I heard about this. Wow, this is great. I never would have thought about this. And then, even if they don't choose to contribute, you will have been planting mental seeds.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is about the initial buy-in.
Yeah.
And our project is running into the same issues. But I think you definitely need to do whatever you can to present it to fresh eyes as an interconnected structure.
It is tricky because I can imagine either of us going to an event and hearing from someone who's so obviously working on a relevant piece of this project, whose work could just be slotted in here, and we'll talk to them about it, and they'll be really excited about it, and then we go our separate ways, and they don't go to the website. They go to the website and they check it out, but they don't create an account. They don't edit the wiki. They're not going to add their content. So we would need someone who's going to chase them down, and put their work up if they won't do it themselves, or urge them to do it. Ariana.
Having an incentive for people to go regularly, there could be some sort of tie-in with events that are news or things that are happening related to these concepts, so sort of put within the paradigms.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I was thinking also in terms of getting person power to contribute and update, to sort of advertise to those types of programs where there are young but qualified and intelligent people who maybe have time. So there are these sort of human rights fellowship programs in the States, I know, and different policy type programs, and maybe if the directors of some of these programs say, you know, this is not necessarily a requirement, but something encouraged to go check this out, and sort of they can create some of the content. And then maybe someone can kind of, I don't know, tie in with things that are going on so that people have a reason to keep checking, so that people in policy, people in the different spheres, there'd be something relevant. It's not dying. It's keeping up. And that wouldn't be that hard, I don't think.
As you're iterating and coming up with new elements of the research, you could do something like, say, as something comes out, host a live chat,
yeah,
and have somebody moderate it and try and get people to come for, you know, a couple of hours to hang out and see what goes on there. There might be a lot of good content created, or even if it's only okay content, you then can filter through, start filling in bubbles, and the people who maybe have been contributing interesting comment, follow up with them and say, hey, you said this, we copied it down here, if you want to edit it at all or add something to it, then that's your opportunity, and that's great.
Yeah, just to give you another sense of what we think the utility would be of the matrix, it would identify scholarship that's needed because it would show gaps, empirical assumptions, and then what scholarship might be able to fill that gap. It would also identify not what scholarship is necessarily needed because there's a gap, but what scholarship is valuable. So to give you an example, I'm often advising law students about a future career in the academy, and they want to know what are projects that they might work on, and they have either another graduate degree or a college BA with a major in psychology, and they've never thought that psychology would have an application to international law or international human rights. The matrix would make it very apparent that that's valuable work and how it might in fact translate into institutional design or scholarship on that kind of a topic. The other that I thought of is it might, separate from the matrix, but then also maybe integrated with the matrix, is the idea that this website could be a clearinghouse or a place that we would collect or archive existing scholarship at these intersections. And that might also create an incentive for people to buy in because they'd want to see their scholarship represented there, or it is a good way to promote or publicize their work. And maybe even generating a part of our list or an email list from the scholars that we identify who are already working at this intersection or working at one part and they don't realize there's an intersection or a bridge to be built. And just to throw out some other ideas of that you might therefore respond to or think, give us any advice on, two other ideas are, when we taught the International Law Workshop, Andrew and I together, students wrote response papers. And we also gave them the opportunity to add to the matrix or create a web page of just applications, and then they could add to that. Interestingly, they didn't add content, though their reaction papers had very interesting insights that could have easily, within 2 minutes, have been added to the website. So they could also make their papers available to others. So they did make their papers available to others in some instances. But the question is, does anonymity help? Is that what the problem was? That they didn't want to expose their experimental idea yet to others and be evaluated by it?
Can I pick up on that just to clarify? Because I was thinking it might be something else. So I'm curious to know whether you think it's anonymity that would keep students from taking, they're writing these response papers, and every one of them, really, every one of them has at the last, you know, they say something about the work, and then they say this could be applied to human rights in X ways, and you could just take that paragraph and slot it into the matrix, and none of them do it. So the question is, are they doing not because they don't want their peers to see the work, or is it because they're just skittish about engaging with this new medium, and it's just easier for them. So if we had a matrix up, people could maybe add content to themselves, or there's a link at the bottom that says, if you'd like your work here, or you know of work that would go here, email us. Would they do that because it's email and they know how to use it, or would they not do it because it's not anonymous still?
One of the things we did, we worked a lot in terms of identity and authenticated anonymity and
yeah.
the ways of handling that. And so there is a lot of evidence that people particularly are afraid of retaliation or theft. Hmm. So there's some very subtle things that a junior person criticizing a senior person, being single, all that kind of stuff. But I still come back to the idea of the matrix and what you're trying to achieve with that. The sort of static notion versus something if you look at a social network, using cloud tags tag clouds to in order to actually create channels where you can then create. So if someone really subscribes to different channels, I mean, you're going to get the same effect, and they're going to have connections to people. And I also think that in some sense, you want to, that if people have effect on the ground, I mean, what's interesting to me, who are the practitioners? Because there's some really interesting groups now actually spun out of DOD, believe it or not, funded by Google, who are using social network stuff to do the logistics on the ground. And it's not called Strong Angel, but there's some really interesting expertise in sort of how you use it, how you know about network theory, how to build viral networks in order to take new kinds of norm formation in critical areas that are affected by where there are really severe human rights infringements. So there may be a different model than just thinking of putting in a network, in a grid.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty. But if actually you're part of a group and getting and you can just post stuff and get stuff back and forth and update, that's very live.
So
like a matrix is sort of. It's really social. It's not publishing a document.
Yeah.
It's connections and relationships that you
want to
build.
But let's say, so that sounds great to me, but the concern would be if this is relevant to someone's work in 10 years and it hasn't been updated much in the last five, would they look at it and think this is dead, or would they, as opposed to a sealed document that's just, it's as if a book had been published in 1975,
I'm an extreme end of the. I think the knowledge of that kind of gets dated very quickly.
Yeah.
And so 10 years out, and I think and all the knowledge is particularly this area is growing so quickly, is situational and social. Mm-hmm. So I'd be less worried about the 10 years out. I think that you're trying, there's sort of an evolving awareness that people are getting, and you need to be part of that, be seen as part of that. Relevant to that conversation, rather than the presence of that, say 10 years out.
I love your idea of connecting research to practice. Having worked with a lot of NGOs internationally and so on, I think that that's going to be really hard to do just online, and I think there is a huge amount of stuff to do if you can work with people in human rights organizations and help matchmake them whose work can actually help them, like help them write a grant proposal, help them write a monitoring and evaluation plan that might actually turn out to be a study of social marketing. But I fear that kind of matchmaking takes a lot of human interaction as well. But I think that's something you could consider. If you could build a community that included both sides of those things, you could find ways to help people find each other. Because I know that for your average nonprofit worker who's overworked, trying to catch up on academic scholarships impossible. But if there was a way they could go and say, hey, I just need someone who's interested in doing this, the whole, then it would get broadcast to the network of young scholars or whoever you were working with, and somebody might come back to them and say, hey, I can help you out with that.
Okay.
Oh my God, what are we going to do wrong? And what's going to fail? And I sort of come at it from a perspective of whatever you're going to create is going to be an evolving iteration. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely to be the great social space that you dream of, because no one can actually get there right now. But there's something to me about thinking about what you're creating online is a sort of community space. And that if you think about what you're creating online as a physical space, and you're setting yourself up to be a community center or some setting, whatever social space you want to create, and you're doing it with some limitations in the authors, you may not be opposed to all the authors' work. The authors might think their commitment is finished on publication of that chapter.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, and getting a critical mass is going to be difficult. But if you sort of take into account all those assumptions and say, well, we're going to try and build something, which might be dated in 2 or 3 years, but if I see so-and-so signed a comment, an interesting comment in a wiki, Google those. I Google those people, see where they've gone to 5 years hence. It doesn't. It can look dead, but it is authentic and recognizes the assumptions it's working with. You're setting sort of target you can get to.
And is there a way? Is there a way? And is there a purpose to stopping something like that at a certain point and saying now it's sealed off, so that if someone arrives at it and we say, look, this was a 3-year project, the 3 years ended, click here to see where these people have gone, or just as a way of saying,
I always click on the about us.
Yeah.
There's a header that says this project was funded through these dates.
Yeah, that's just.
We now point you in the direction of the author's website who are here. And embed, not trying to perhaps create some wonderful electronic real estate unconnected and unembedded.
Mm.
You embed it in delicious tagging systems, and you embed it institutionally within Berkman and or others, and then institutionally within the human rights framework. The new tactics project out of the sense of victims of torture is particularly, I think, interesting.
Example of what they tried to do. Yeah. So that's just to reinforce that point, I think that when you're doing anything like that, you're going to fail. So you're going to have small experiments, you're going to learn from it.
Yeah.
And you don't put everything on the line. So, okay, it's either going to go or not go.
Yeah.
And so and part of that is then learning about, is listening to the whole user-generated content side of things, so that actually learning. So if it's just one way, it doesn't take. I mean, you can say, oh, this is how they're coming out. These are, and it is really learning from your customers, so to speak, and being receptive to that. I think that's very critical. It's such a success.
So we've had a couple other people come through here talking about the impossibility of trying to predict outcomes just like this. And it seems to me that you know, you're describing that you're risk-averse.
Yeah.
I'm sure that makes sense. But the only reason you're risk-averse is because you're looking ahead and saying, we want it to be this
right.
10 years from now or even 5 years from now. And I think that that's why you're thinking, oh, geez, you know, it's probably not going to work. I think maybe a better way to think about it is that the moment you crystallize a desired outcome, the chances of you failing are almost 100%.
Yeah.
Because you just narrowed your solution space to one, you know what
right.
I mean? So the thing to do, it seems to me, and you've got these amazing ideas, and already you've got people participating, and there's all these cross links, is don't try to design an outcome, try to design a tool whose uses you can't imagine.
Yeah.
And then if it's rich, somebody's gonna show up and say, wow, this is just what I need. And you would never have thought of that. And then it's not going to matter whether it's a dead space or a closed space, it's just useful. And so then you can't fail. It's because it's just there, it's raw material.
That's great. Solon?
I mean, I'm just curious if maybe this is the question, but I mean, in your mind, like, who are the constituents? Like, I mean, it seems to me we can think about like an information flow from the academy to practitioners, or it could be the reverse, where practitioners are filling in those particular cells in the matrix. But I don't know. That, to me, doesn't seem like user-generated content. That seems like something different. And I'm wondering if the social aspect here should be compared to like more traditional understandings of user-generated content. So I don't know. Do I have it wrong? Are the constituents... So I think you're right when you say like we shouldn't have a solution in mind when we set up the system. But I do think it would be helpful to think more clearly about who you would proselytize, I guess, in the initial phase, right, to get involved. That's the question.
Yeah, that's good. We're not sure is the answer, and that explains, I think, our ambivalence about all of the forms of doing this.
So, just to add a bit, is the definite constituent at the is one of which is the practitioner, and then building into account a very clear-eyed understanding that they have a very limited capacity to digest academic research. And so there've got to be other ways in which this tool would be even more user-friendly for those purposes of translating the information. And maybe also the matchmaking in terms of putting some of the practitioners in touch with academics and academic research that could really help them. And that was actually one of the most remarkable things about the retreat that we had when we brought these different people together, and it worked. Though at the same time, maybe it's the way in which we structured it, whereby I think many of the practitioners thought that the constituents were the academics, so that's the way in which they came to it, and they thought, okay, I've got to operate at this academic level and then tell the academics what might be helpful or what isn't or what's harebrained. And they engaged at that level, and there was a part of which I thought it's remarkable that they had sitting at the table, for example, people who work on social marketing in the public health sector, and they didn't just try to tap them for all they're worth. Because we had this full-day retreat, but rather we're trying to be helpful in the other respect. And I think this loop into practice and practitioners, I think, is one of the most important for us. And then the other one is generating more scholarship and ideas by academics and graduate students and the like. The other one is that, just as a caveat, realizing that this is webcast, it's interesting that the contributors that we got to the book are the leading figures in their field, and that came with some limitations. And there's another kind of a project in which the same thing could have been done with graduate students who would have, I think, more looked more at the existing field, not their particular relationship to that field. To generate ideas from the field itself rather than their particular research program, and also maybe being a little bit more willing to go from descriptive to prescriptive, because that was one of these other bridges that it's incredible the degree to which these academics are willing to do that. But that's another constituency in which we're trying to promote and build up the scholarship itself to make people in areas of research realize that they have, with just a few turns of the screw, very significant things to say about human rights promotion. And they haven't yet, or their field hasn't yet done that.
So one possibility is to look at that as an opportunity. You've collected work from leading scholars. There are dozens of grad students who presumably want their work to be noticed by these people. If you provide them a site where they can get a place to publish their work pre-formal peer-reviewed publication, engage possibly with one another, possibly they're the people who would get sort of academic benefit from connecting up with these other disciplines before the people who already have their research agenda set. And even if the original authors never check back to the site,
that's a great idea, and we could even provide a suggested citation for how you would cite the page, and then a young scholar could see that their name would be going next to these luminaries' names. It might be a good incentive.
I mean, along those lines. Generally, I think the whole idea is we need to create as many platforms for engagement as possible,
yeah.
And see as much content as you can draw in, mm-hmm. And whatever the form that the varying success of those engagements takes is really going to suggest both in the near to medium term what structure the site will take and then what the end product will be.
Yeah.
There's no end product there without the content. So okay. Worry about creating the spaces for engagement and production of the content first, and then everything else. There are plenty of ways to imagine that once that problem is solved.
And then just feeding off of that a bit, one question I have, and I'm further behind than the median in the room for sure in terms of understanding of internet savviness, etc., but quality control. So Wiki works so successfully, is my understanding, because of just the mass number of people that are viewing the websites. And if we allow or open this up to people being able to post into the metric, their understanding of applications and things like that. How would you all design quality control? Do we have editors who rework that content or exclude the content? Does that alienate would-be participants? How do you all think about that kind of a question? Is it that it's best that people submit their ideas to an editor or a group of editors and then they decide what to upload? Or
you could have different zones. So you can, I mean, you can have a more open zone and a more edited zone. But then, the wiki model, there are people who are more best than others. And there is a question of fact checking. Editorial quality. But I think that you risk the danger if you overly intrude, then you disincentive people. And sometimes the raw stuff is really, and people are not afraid to be judged on what comes out.
I would say
every
editor should have a
quality
control team. The naive input is potentially a learning moment for the person who's contributed, but it's very easy to set up that learning moment in a way that pretty much kills any future input. So I think zones is one way to handle it. And the other thing is to be open. You've got to handle porn spam or that sort of stuff, but excluding those sort of problems, you want people to contribute. You can teach them and then the contributor who knows nothing substantively may still know how to place commas. You know, there's a way of building that. It's very easy to dissuade people, even in very, very subtle ways. You call these editors, they're going to be, oh, my stuff's going to be edited. If they are just a fellow contributor who said, I fixed your stuff and I've emailed you to say, we made these few changes. Yeah. I'm a fellow contributor here. It's a very different message than being edited.
Well, if you're building a page with concrete suggestions on human rights, the immediate danger is the attraction of zealots, which is probably going to be much more dangerous than any of the spam comments, because you probably have to think about how you deal with an audience who's, you know, really happy about contributing, but they're not necessarily contributing the sort of things with the ideology that you want on the page. And I mean, you can handle that through moderation, etc. And the second part is attribution. So if you're building citation formats for these things, how do you attribute a page that's been edited by 20 people 100 times? Where you can pull things out, like you say, with the zones, you can figure out who's edited what and put that in a concrete version and have a discussion area for that.
One thing, there's an inherent danger here is that you have implicit notions of expertise. And academic expertise versus practitioner expertise versus what's important. And people have a different sense of they're trying to get something done. It's great that they've done this thing in neuroscience, and that's a good thing. I can't use that. And so you can have, and being able to balance that off, I think is particularly tricky in this environment, because you're going to have the luminary. That's wonderful, but that's not really relevant to what I'm trying to do. It's not really useful knowledge, and there's a real difference between them. And that may be a very useful finding in an academic, and you get papers and tenures and glory, hallelujah, and all that, but in terms of affecting things on the ground, and even within that community, you have different people who are doers and managers and thought leaders and stuff like that. And so there's a lot of disparity within that. Mm-hmm.
Any other comments? Does anyone know of examples of something like this where someone has tried to create, whether it was collaborative or not, someone tried to map the field in a particular, it must exist, right?
I mean, the Wikipedia Research Hub, that's sort of what they're trying to do.
Media okay. Research Hub on?
Yeah, I'm spending it on.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm. All right.
to describe it. It wasn't anything nearly as ambitious as this. It was just kind of posting basic graphs of trends in social inequality, and then inviting scholars to come basically post their reading of that data. And it was supposed to be a way to encourage people from different disciplines to debate, basically, like, what accounts for these trends. And it was an enormous failure, like, a true failure. And what I realized then was, I mean, not only had it been a failure in terms of the way it was set up institutionally, but it's just really hard to get scholars to spend their free time contributing to some kind of project like that.
Yeah.
And even with financial incentives,
yes,
it wasn't going to go anywhere. So, but, I mean, I can talk to you about that more in private.
Okay. Sounds good.
The Center for Basement, which is new tactics.
Yeah.
Quite an interesting global project to map it.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you have them,
we should talk to them because they have their. The way they set up the, I like the way they set up the website, and I like the ambition. But I signed up for email alerts and was getting them, and thought the quality of a lot of the posts for What Are New Tactics was so low that it was not worth it to receive the emails anymore, and I canceled it. And so, and it's just such a shame because it's such, it seems like such a great idea. Yeah, exactly. That's the problem is, yeah. So how do we create? How do we not replicate their mistakes?
Is what's going on in the world of such a quantity that by taking up nothing to something more, it might not feel
that's,
like what it should be.
Yeah.
I think it comes back to the question of recruitment and seeding.
Yeah.
You identify specific people and the kinds of people who want to get involved, and you see how you can leverage that. But I think also that winded point of trying to get grad students involved
is
exactly the right thing. And so, look at the, say, scholars who want to get involved and contact their research assistants. And say, you know, and see if you can just get the go-ahead to, like, for them to cut and paste some of that research in.
Well, on that very note, if any of you want to get involved or know anyone who does want to get involved, my email is awoods@law. Please, seriously, if you know people who you think are just right for this, have them email me.
To which face-to-face interaction is important in this field, it might be some sort of a legitimate incentive to say, I don't know exactly how to structure it, but for those who contribute, you know, this amount, there's a yearly or a biannual get-together, somewhat low budget, but there's, you know, this opportunity, there's a big person here, and you can, and then, you know, maybe the luminaries also like the idea of recruiting some people who can do some work for them, and, you know, not just an online community, but some hope of it.
Great.
Can we get your authors to commit to a gathering once a year and then invite practitioners and students?
Yeah.
I know that the Free Culture at Harvard is working with an initiative to create a database of scholarly works here.
Yeah.
You know, Harvard now has the rights to publish all research that's done under the Harvard banner.
Yeah.
And they're currently faced with a lot of the same. Exploring, you know, finding grad students and actually even have a small budget for work study for grad students and assigning each grad student a different school or a different just set of academics to go try to chase them down and get their stuff published online.
Okay.
They also have different challenges as to when the stuff gets released online because sometimes they want to publish the author's copy rather than, you know, the initial published copy. So there's a lot of follow-up work that has to be done, and there are other databases to track all of that.
That's great, Go for it.
I was just going to rewind a little bit to the interaction in person. It's like, I don't know what kind of conferences or events already exist, but just dovetailing off of those and having different sessions in which the people have already been brought together and integrating it into the existing framework.
And another thing that the Free Culture how to set up almost competitions to encourage people, just trying to hit that critical mass point where the culture changes and people just start using it. And one of the things that they were exploring, which I don't know if it's relevant to you or not, is posting, you know, percentage of, you know, academics in this particular school that have their articles online as a percentage of each school,
like,
and then displaying
thing.
Their stats on
the
front
page. That's great.
Just to encourage a little friendly competition.
That's great.
Like a leaderboard.
Yeah.
Since been thrown out, I think lead towards the conclusion that rather than a certain type of technology, what you guys are actually after is a community. And by getting the right community, you know, they might work through whatever technology it would be. So your concerns about having something that would die really reflect the fact that you're concerned that you won't be able to engage a large enough group or an active enough group to, I don't know, perpetuate something.
Yeah.
And by working maybe, you know, to off Solon's question, by trying to identify your constituents and finding the right group of people, I don't think you'll have to worry about what format it's in, because you'll have people that will work through the format, possibly even, as Adam said, improve the format, and really, you know, keep your project going for you.
Yeah, one thought I've had about that, and it kind of ties in with the face-to-face opportunities, is there's another constituency out there of philanthropists who are leaders of philanthropic foundations are very keenly interested in what works and what fails with the human rights NGOs. And so they would be very interested in this kind of research, because they also don't have the time to tap into academic research. But what human rights NGO wouldn't want to be at that conference where philanthropists are meeting with the academics? We tell them what works and what fails, and there's real buy-in. Now, I don't know if that's the right kind of incentive, but it's the strange world of human rights in which even your friends and your allies are people that you're trying to please or educate, and there's tension there. But the philanthropic world, I think, is another area that we've even just thought about having that meeting, not between the human rights activists, but the philanthropic foundations and the academics. Because that's a bridge that just hasn't been built, but my understanding is that there's a lot of interest in it.
Great. I think we're at time, so we'll call it. But thanks for your feedback. Again, it's A. Woods at Law. If you have any feedback, comments, whatever. Thanks.